it's Fern here, popping in quickly before the show because I really want to hear from you. I am forever grateful to you every single time you press play on an episode of Happy Place. And this show really is for you. So in the interest of doing more stuff that you love and less of the stuff you're not bothered by, I would love it if you took a couple of minutes to fill out a little survey for me. The link will be in the show notes. Your input on the content and the format and the guests and all those types of things is so important to help me and the Happy Place team shape the future of Happy Place. So just click on the link in the show notes to share all your thoughts and musings. I appreciate you loads. Hello, I'm Fern Cotton and this is Happy Place, the show that aims to help you overcome your limiting beliefs about your capabilities. Today, I'm chatting to Bear Grylls.
I just know tradition is humans. It's how we're at our best. We're best in the struggle. And when we stop pushing ourselves and we stop taking the risks and we stop doing the uncomfortable, we stagnate. And like in nature, nothing stands still. It's either going backwards or it's going forwards. And I think so much of people's anxiety is about change and new things. I'll never forget the words written over. It's written on the barracks of the Commando Training Centre at Lympston. It's written there on the officer's mess as you go in, comfortable with uncertainty.
A former Special Forces soldier, Bear, has for years and years and years been an incredibly well-loved face on our TV screens as the man who's taken everyone from Julia Roberts to President Obama out into the wild for a survival adventure. And yes, there's obviously a huge amount of physical ability involved in that, but it's mental resilience in the face of life's challenges that Bear's particularly interested in. He's written a book called Mind Fuel, and I just love the principles he talks about in it. Pushing yourself into slight discomfort, challenging yourself in new scenarios, that's where we're going to grow. That's where we're going to impress ourselves with things we didn't know we could do. That's where we'll all discover new parts of ourselves, perhaps even exciting parts that deviate from the story we've always told about who we are.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
All right, let's do it. This is the show. Bear Grylls, I think we're going to have a very interesting chat today.
Mm.
We've got so much to talk about. So much
to
talk
you.
About. Because mental health, I know, is obviously it's something that I'm deeply passionate about, but it's something that you have to focus on acutely, whether it's you adventuring or if you're setting up a TV show and people are adventuring. Yeah. And obviously you've written this new book, Mind Fuel, which more specifically looks at mental resilience. And I'm intrigued by mental resilience because I never quite know if I'm meant to push myself a bit further to cultivate resilience or if I should be slowing down, being a bit softer to seek peace. I'd never quite know what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, I think there's a balance and a space in life for both, isn't there? You know, it's a bit like going to the gym. You know, when you're in the gym, you train hard and you're sweating. It doesn't mean you want to live 24/7 like that and be exhausted. Then there's a time to come home and take a long, cool shower and have a cup of tea. And I think life is that. I think building mental resilience is like that. It's great equipping ourselves with simple tools that can help us before the storms of life come. But one thing we do know is that the storms always do come in whatever fashion. Sometimes it's something spectacular, huge and terrifying and life-changing. For many people, it's just a day-to-day struggle and battle and grind. But I think being on the front foot in terms of building our mental resilience or positive mental health or mental fitness or whatever we call it is a smart thing. And it's obviously not going to solve everything because life isn't like that. And mental health is much more complex than that. But likewise, going to the gym isn't going to guarantee you're never going to get ill. But it's about doing simple things that are going to make us a little bit stronger and hopefully equip us a little bit better for the storms that do always come.
Yeah. I mean, you say in the book, you know, we should always be sort of thinking bigger and at times really pushing ourselves to our limits. When do you know if you should surrender and step back and go, actually, I'm out?
Well, you've gone straight for the million-dollar question.
Oh, God, have I?
Well,
No, but it's... I've peaked too soon. Is this the end of the podcast already?
In terms of mental health, you've just hit the summit. You just stumbled under the summit. Because that's called the wisdom of life, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that comes with time and experience. And generally, in my own experience, it comes with failure and figuring it and getting it wrong. And sometimes not having a listening ear enough, and sometimes pushing too hard, and sometimes not pushing hard enough. And we learn with experience and through failure where that line is and how to get that balance. But there is always that line, and you should never be like, I mean, I'm always saying to our kids, never give up, never give up. But there's certain things you should give up in. Smoking.
Yeah, true. You know, that's probably not a great one.
There's always a time where sometimes we need to, there's a different way. We need to hold back. We need to listen. Maybe the world's telling us something. Maybe our bodies are telling us something. And that's just wisdom and experience and having a good instinct. And I always think instinct is the nose of the mind. You know, we've got to listen to it.
Because you say in the book that the only times that you've had real regret is exactly for that reason, when you haven't listened. And that's obviously manifested in quite physical, I don't know if they're failures, but stumbling blocks, like getting bitten by a viper in Borneo because you were pushing yourself to the limits in that circumstance. How do you live with regret? How do you sit with it?
Well, first of all, I think the wild is always a great teacher, and it's a great sort of metaphor always for life, isn't it? And sometimes you're right, I've been bitten not just by the snakes, but by the wild because I haven't listened. You know, you don't listen to that gut inside at your own peril in life and in relationships and in our dreams and in the wild. And I've definitely been bitten a few times by that, by, you know, not listening. How do you live with regret? I think you've got to try and keep your eyes forward. You know, keep your eyes forward, looking back. There are always things we could do better. You know, I haven't said that. I'm not one of these people who, you know, sometimes people go, have you got any regrets? And they go, no regrets.
I've got loads.
I know, and I'm thinking,
I've got tons. Yeah, I've got some that I feel really bad about still as well. Like some I feel complete like acceptance and there's self-compassion, but there's some I feel rotten about. And I think that's completely normal.
And good. And it's a symbolic of your big heart. Mm. And that's okay. I think the thing of no regrets ever, I'm always thinking, gosh, wow. You know, because we've all messed up. We've all hurt people. We've all done things wrong. My regrets are generally about that sort of stuff. But I think a lot of the hard mental struggles people go through is often about looking back too much and beating ourselves up too much about stuff. And you got to try. You know, it's always easy to say it as more than do it, but try and live in that moment to keep your eyes moving forward. And everything's a lesson, and everything hopefully builds us a little bit and makes us stronger. And we've got to keep moving forward, and sometimes it's then three steps back, but keep your eyes forward and keep getting back up. And you know, I think tentative steps in life are okay, but keep the tentative steps going forward.
Yeah, there's some extreme examples that you outline in the book as well with that mindset of being in the now. And of course, when you're in nature or on a great adventure, you have to be in the now because you need to stay alert and you need to have your ears and all senses ready for whatever's going to come next. And you mentioned someone that I greatly respect, Alex Honnold. I loved the film Free Solo. It terrified me. I felt utterly sick watching it. Like, I was just seeing him scale. Okay, so Alex scales
set the scene
this.
For people.
It's a vertical, it's just a sheer drop, a vertical cliff that he's scaling without a rope in Yosemite National Park. It's unfathomable. I don't understand. But you say that this was possible because he had this incredible mindset where he's able to oscillate between a sort of pure relaxed state, but also super engaged state. And I don't know if I've ever experienced that. You know, maybe I try and do that when I'm interviewing or doing a job that requires some nerves. I'm not scaling a mountain, but I think I try and land in that place. But it's a really complex mindset to get yourself in. It's almost paradoxical. So
yeah.
Is that one that you get with practice? I mean, I'm not thinking we're all aiming to scale vertical cliffs here, but for other moments in life where we need to be alert but not tense and stressed, we need to be relaxed with it.
Wisdom again, isn't it? You know, it's a goal is to find that great state. And I think it does come with practice. That is essentially what mindfulness is trying to practice to be in the present a little bit. And Alex's incredible, you know, feat on El Cap and, you know, won an Oscar for that film. I mean, it's visceral and beautiful and powerful, but was a supreme example of you got to be in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that great quote, the past is history, the future's a mystery, the now is a gift. That's why we call it the present. And I love that, you know, it is the present. It's a great gift. All the great stories, how many great films are there about this? You know, it's like, it's all we have, you know, with the flaws, with the failures, with the struggles, with the everything that comes at us in life. It's what a gift.
Mm.
What a gift. And I think his, you know, his feat was a supreme example of that. And he's such a lovely guy. And in fact, I've taken him on a running wild before. And he was one of our guests on that show, which was an interesting dynamic, because normally, you know, I'm taking these, you know, these Hollywood folk or sports stars or whatever, they're always rookies in terms of the wild, you know.
Yeah.
So, but with Alex, obviously, here's a guy who is numero uno.
Mm.
And so I was like, Alex, here's a rope.
Yeah, bye.
I'm on your shirt tails, brother, you know. And I remember reaching this rock face with him, and it was like, you know, vertical, you know, 100-foot rock face. And I said, Alex, you've got to lead on this, you know, and just pick a good route and be gentle. And here we go, we're going up this way. And he grabs a rope, starts up this thing. And then I kind of lose him because he goes over this overhang bit and I can't see him. And then the rope sort of stops and nothing happens for about 5 minutes. And I'm like, you know, you're right? And I go, okay, you good? And you go, yeah, all right, Ben, just really tricky bit at the moment. I'm thinking, I'm dead.
You think it's tricky. I'm
dead. I saw Ted to Munger, the cameraman. Munger was like laughing. I'm going, I'm screwed, you know. And sure enough, Alex sort of hauling me up this thing. You know? But what I like about Alex as well is that he's the first to say, I struggle living like that when I'm off the rock. And I think a lot of life for us is finding our rock, finding our place where we can be in the moment. And it might be jumping out of a plane for somebody. It might be on a rock face. It might be doing a podcast. It might be riding your motorbike or whatever your thing is, you know. But there is a magic to things that force us to have that focus. And I think a good practice then is to know that feeling and to try and bring it into other areas slowly of our life. But
that's hard, isn't it, though?
Well, all
to
of
bring
us
it into the sort of mundane. I think that's really hard, because in the mundane, which we all experience, because there's washing to be done, or there's, you know, kids to ferry about, or whatever's going on, or there's just you've got loads of paperwork, whatever it might be, to not race forward or back in those moments is so tricky. To go, how do I apply that mindset just to be in the now, to have gratitude, whatever it might be? That's weirdly trickier.
Super hard. And all of us are a massive work in progress.
Yeah.
But it's important in life to know where we're aiming. And I think that is a great goal to have. It's that thing of, it's super hard to get where you want to in life when you know where you're going. It's near impossible if you don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
You know, it's great to have that goal of like, guy, hold on, just breathe. It's okay. You know, traffic's bad, but we're super lucky. Kids are at home. They're back from school. They can't wait to see you. Do you want to, whatever the simple things that are, and that's a daily practice.
You're obviously incredibly mentally strong because of what you do and what you've learned and what you've just imbibed from being in this line of work. But
don't know. I wouldn't jump to necessarily that conclusion. You know, I think people do jump to that conclusion, and I sit here thinking, well, I don't know.
What areas do you then struggle with? In which areas do
you feel? How
long
have you got for the podcast? You know what I mean? You know,
well, I think people need to hear this long list.
Well, I'm different, you know, really to anyone else. I have a job that involves adventure and I love and I'm relatively okay at. But, you know, beyond that, everyday life is, you know, we all have our stuff we struggle with. I still really struggle with big groups of people. You know, I have done all my life, always quite shy. I mean, I have an older sister who's really extrovert, 8 years older. And always when I was growing up, you know, she'd be like 16. I'd be super shy, sort of 8. she'd be dragging me into a group of that, all be smoking and sort of, you know, and then she'd get me to dance like a seal. And I'd be like, I'd be dying inside, but I didn't have the sort of confidence to sort of go, no, you know. So, you know.
That's such a great vision.
I don't know. Maybe does it come from that? I don't know. But there were a zillion examples like that. You know, Bella, hold on, babe, I'll get my brother. I'll get my baby brother. Come and eat the raw bacon. Watch this, guys. Watch this. It's epic. I'm like, oh, please, no. She's like, I'll give you 10p. Oh, God. Okay. You know. And people go, well, no wonder you have a job eating wacky things. But it's not a comfortable place for me. I struggle with the cameras. Really struggle with
cameras. Do you really?
Really struggle.
I would never, ever have guessed that.
You know, just almost the word is hard for me. I really...
And in terms of what bit do you not
like? I don't like the camera.
Seen.
I just don't like the camera. I'm really happy. You know, look at where we are now. I'd be... If you want to really make me happy, let me lie on that grass...
With Simon the
cat. With your cat in the sun.
He's having a great time.
You know? And we're... You know... That's, you know, so anyway, with the cameras here, you know, I do it's my job and, you know, kind of get on with it. It's fine. It's fine. And also, I'm kind of not scared to do the things that I find difficult. I actually think that's not a bad thing in life. And it's definitely part of Mind Fuel is embrace the uncomfortable, be comfortable with the uncertainty, do the difficult stuff, do it long enough and we get stronger. I know that. But it doesn't change the fact that it is a tricky, difficult, anxious making place for me. And those who know me and are my close friends know it all too well, and even our camera team, they go, okay, just for good no, you know, somebody new comes in the camera team, just never say action, just quietly turn
is
on the camera
and
let's just keep moving,
we just keep moving.
And it's always like that, you know. And then it's like I'm just with a bunch of guys and we're out there and we're going this way, come on down, you take that one, and it's going to be a blast. Here we go. And that's really the spirit of the TV shows I've always done and Running Wild. But it's essentially born out of trying to get away from the cameras. And it's a running joke with the Running Wild crew. It's like, where's he gone? Where have they gone? You know, and then I've sat with the guests and we're chatting and they go, this is so nice, but it's not on camera. Is it? I go, no, but they're catching
it. It's great, yeah.
You know, and you get enough of the conversation anyway, but I always think the bulk of it happens when I've successfully managed to evade the crew.
It's so funny. I mean, I probably feel similar. I think when I'm doing a podcast, I almost forget that we're even filming it, and I'm more conscious about, oh my God, what opinion should I put forward here, or what story should I tell? But I think I've got a discomfort with sort of presenting in front of a camera, because I think, oh, I don't know if that's really me. I don't know if that's...
Yeah.
And I definitely have the big crowd thing. I'm not good at big parties or any of that. I feel, and my husband's exactly the same, like very anxious about it. I much prefer one-on-one or small groups. And
so much nicer.
Yeah, but it's interesting how...
I find it gets worse over the years.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does.
I'm really trying to stop this decline because it's a really bad decline. It's like, come on. You know. And
actually,
Shara is great. My wife is she's great. She, you know, she's much more... She loves... I mean, she isn't like a massive party, but she's much more kind of comfortable with stuff. She's always going like, come on. I mean, I actually even broach it now. I said like, come on, we're going, it's fine.
Yeah, but it's interesting.
But it's not
again,
a happy place. And some people get energy from it, don't they? And some people get drained from it. And I've seen that so much in my job as my role as chief scout. You know, we're always going around these huge scout camps. And I love that. It's a wonderful kind of energy from so many of the scouts hearing their stories, doing amazing stuff. But it is also quite draining. I find it quite draining. And it's interesting. Whenever I've taken like guests along to come and join me for a day or something, often at the end, they go, oh, I'm buzzing. They're like, He-Man, like, I'm buzzing. The adrenaline, I'll be signing autographs all day and like selfies all day. And I'm like, I'm broken.
Yeah, I'm lying on the floor in a pool of my own blood. Yeah.
And I find it really interesting seeing some people sort of get a real, and I kind of wish I was more like that.
Yeah,
more,
I think it's an extrovert introvert thing. Like the trait is that, are you drained or are you boosted?
I am absolutely drained. So you like that?
Absolutely drained. Yeah. I can take... You know, I feel very excited being in groups of people, and whether we're discussing something or just, you know, having a laugh. Mm. But I need absolute solitude to counter it massively.
Yeah, good. That's really nice to hear.
Yeah.
That actually really...
We're not alone, Bear. We're not alone.
There's a very good book on this, and I can't remember what it's called now. But anyway, it sort of affirms the fact that that's That's okay.
It's a thing. It's
okay.
Completely a thing. Do you know what I love about this book? It's a very individual, unique concept in that you've gone through 365 days of a year, but every 2 days, sort of thematically, there's something for us to mull over, but also questions to ask ourselves that I found really interesting as a sort of personal exercise. Like, what is the answer to that question? Is that something that you've sort of implemented into your day over years, that you'll ask yourself questions, challenge yourself, challenge your opinion, challenge your own limits?
Questions are really good, aren't they? And actually, we wrote this, we spoke to so many psychologists and psychiatrists and leading mental health experts and stuff. And one of the things that always came back is always put it back then to the reader. And I think that's smart, because you talk about something, you say maybe, you know, here we go, going for a walk with a buddy, you know, the healing benefits, the scientific things of actually why this is so good, or whatever we're talking about. But then at the end, just throwing it back, going, do you sometimes avoid spending that good time with a good friend for various reasons? You know, whenever you put it back to the reader and it's like, oh gosh, I do probably do that. And it throws it back, and it's always challenging for all of us, but it's only ever meant to be empowering and like, oh, and it's like, you know, maybe how would it feel to reach out today and ring an old friend and say you miss him? You know, the question is always more powerful than ring an old friend.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Well, it's having self-awareness, I guess, then, isn't it? And knowing what your own traits are, and I guess what your own limits are, and how far you can push yourself. My brain's jumping all over the shop, but I've just had another thought, and it kind of links to us talking about the introvert-extrovert thing. And I wonder, as you seem to have had a sense of that when you were a kid, I think I probably did as well to an extent. I had a sense that I found big crowds, or I was certainly tired after going to birthday parties, things like that.
Yeah.
Do you think you kind of lean towards adventure and taking yourself off, imagining quite a lot of the time when you were younger, solo, to get that space, to
all
get away
time.
From people?
It was totally that.
Yeah.
It came from two reasons. One is that, I used to love doing that with my dad. You know, my late dad had been a commando, you know, Marine, loved all the outdoor stuff, and always my time, it was fighting to get back from school just to be able to go with him, even if the weather was terrible, just something about sort of being out together. And we'd climb these little, tiny little things, like 100-foot steep scrambles up these, you know, muddy banks, and it was, you'd always be end up wet and covered in mud and, you know, together. And that just that time with him was really special. And I think subconsciously it was always about just that, the bonds, the togetherness, the laughing, the wind, the rain, the healing nature of all of that. It's all happening accidentally to me as a kid, and I didn't even know it.
Yeah.
That was one. The other one then was dodging my bossy sister when I was there. And listen, I don't want you to get impressed. My sister and me are super close. And she's one of them. I don't want her listening to this podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Beth.
I can see the days where Beth, everyone tells me I'm really bossy. You know.
But I think my brother would say exactly the same about me, to be honest.
Okay. But so my sister's amazing. But I would definitely always, I quite like just taking myself off down the garden and had it built an epic tree house. And I loved that. And I spend so much time. And I think because I was that much younger, I was almost like a bit of an only child for a lot of those years when she was away at school. And I loved, I just loved that. So those became comfortable places. And then also, I think when I went to school, I realized the one thing I was good at was climbing. I wasn't particularly brilliant at all the other stuff, but I found one thing. I was always the kid that could climb the highest building up the drain pipe, and you know, I was good at that stuff, and I got called, my nickname at school was Monkey, you know, it was, yeah, so it's either bear or monkey. Do you know what I mean? The clues were there. So I suppose those were spaces that allowed me to retreat a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, one of your first major adventures was when you reached the summit of Everest at, you're 23, is that right? Which is no mean feat, and there are incredible risks at play when you do something like that. Do you think you've always been quite good naturally at being able to, I don't know if you sideline the risks, but sort of understand them, but not let them stop you doing what you want to do?
It's a nice way of putting it, but I think it was not as articulate as that for me. It was more like, I think at a young age, I was just out, I wanted to make my mark, you know, and I think I'd just, that Everest stuff happened after I'd had to leave the job I was doing in the military, when I broke my back in that freefall accident and spending all that time in hospital. That was definitely for me a real struggle and a dark time of something I couldn't do the job that I'd loved to do and I'd done, and been was such a huge part of my life, was all my life at that age, you know, in the military. And suddenly now I can't even reach a bathroom, you know, without being like crying in pain. And it's like, this is hopeless. This is hopeless. You know, what am I going to do? And I think coming through, the thing that helped me so much in that hospital was just having a real goal. And even though it was a crazy goal of Everest, and it felt like such a distant goal, it was something to hold on to. And I'd had the dream as a really young kid from my dad. We always had a picture of Everest on my wall, and it was just a kind of thing, you know. And in some ways, I wonder if I hadn't had that accident to actually bring this thing into kind of focus of like, that's what I'm gonna reach a bathroom without pain. I'm gonna reach the next floor of this hospital, up the stairs, and then I'm gonna figure out how to get down the stairs, and then I'm gonna do two flights. And I could just break this thing down, and it was subconsciously a symbol for me. I'm not going to be beaten by this, and I'm one day going to stand on top of the world. And I think I look at it now, such a big part of it was that, but also wanting to make my mark. I was like, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to be better and stronger than ever before. And it was like almost a desperate sort of act in a way, but I really wanted, it was that symbol of my recovery. And it was flawed in so many ways, because it needs to always come from inside. And the risk taking, you know, Everest at the time was killing 1 in 6 people who reached the top. To me, those statistics were just fuel and almost romantic. And it's like, no, we're going to defy the odds. And, you know, it's blind in some ways. And I look back now and I kind of, you know, I wonder, yeah, you don't need to make your mark in life. You know, you don't have to climb that kind of thing, but things that give us hope have real value, whatever they are. And even though it was kind of flawed and there was a romantic sort of craziness about it, and now I understand the reality of what 1 in 6 mean. You know, we lost 4 people up there. I came back in some ways less confident than I went. You know, I'm less sure of it all now. But at the time, it was such a symbol of like, this is what I'm going to do. And it was a bit more blind to the risks, I think.
I think most
makes
of
sense.
Us
is a bit of a
absolutely
ramble,
makes sense. And I think probably in our teens and 20s, if you're lucky enough to have kind of grown up without any massive trauma, you are kind of up for trying things and taking risks. And there's certainly things that I did, even like silly things back in the day, that I think I'd never do that now. And I think it does get harder to take risks as you get older. And I guess the danger is becoming completely stuck and not taking any risks. And I think it just gets harder.
The greatest risk.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's true. In terms of our life, in terms of our happiness, in terms of our relationships, in terms of our aspirations, I go, you know, we as humans are designed to struggle and to fight and to strive.
We forget
and
that.
And to fail, you know, and the clues all around us in nature. You know, look what happens to a pond in nature when you dam it up. And you stop that water moving, you know, just get stagnant. You know, we're designed for the white water and the off the cliffs and in, and it creates life and oxygen and power and energy. And, you know, so we was never lose a risk-taking spirit. I think with wisdom comes an understanding of how to manage risk. You know, you've got to stay alive. You're a mum, you're a dad. You've got a lot to live for. You know, you've got to make smart choices, you know, or me on Running Wild with these guests. I've got their lives in my hand. You can't be, don't be a dick.
Yeah.
You know, be smart. Keep them alive. Leave the ego behind. Get it right. Yeah. That's a given. But within that, we should never lose our risk-taking, embracing spirit of like all in. You know,
I find that so liberating, because I can have quite an anxious disposition and think, no, especially, well, I think since becoming a mum, you know, before in my 20s, I was quite reckless at times in lots of different ways. And I would go all over the shop, all around the world, try new things and whatever. And since I have kids, I've become very like, oh, I don't want to, even if it is about travel, I don't want to jet lag them, or what if this happens and that doesn't happen? And I tie myself in knots with what ifs, and then I am like static and I don't do anything.
Yeah.
And I feel really clipped and sometimes edgy and frustrated. Mm. And I find it really liberating you saying, no, we're built for this. We're built for the white waters.
And way more than we ever imagined.
Yeah.
And also with our kids, the kids are so, you only build your resilience through those times of, yeah, you're jet lagged.
Yeah.
But yeah, help your sister still with her cases. Come on, you know? It's okay. You're gonna wake up tomorrow morning. It's
I need
okay.
this spare. Keep you know? Speaking.
But I do think, I just know tradition is humans. It's how we're at our best. We're best in the struggle. And when we stop pushing ourselves and we stop taking the risks and we stop doing the uncomfortable,
yeah,
we stagnate. And like in nature, nothing stands still. It's either going backwards or it's going forwards. And I think so much of people's anxiety is about change and new things.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget the words written over. It's written on the barracks of the Commando Training Center at Lympston, Royal Marines Base. You walk in, written there on the officer's mess as you go in, etched into the wood, comfortable with uncertainty.
Mm.
Powerful words, three words, comfortable with uncertainty. It's like lesson one you're going to need to learn here is not how to do press-ups. It's not how to shoot a rifle. It's not. Lesson one is embrace that change. Get comfortable with the uncomfortable, with the uncertainty. And most people aren't. And when we are confronted, therefore, with the uncertainty, we panic. Why do we panic? Purely because we're not used to it.
Yeah.
You know, but when you're used to it, it's a muscle. We train it. We get used to it. Then when you're thrown into a proper storm, that muscle is strong, you know. And it's a daily discipline to do the difficult. I see it all the time. It's the one unifying factor I see on every running wild guess I've ever taken. Bear in mind, all these guests, they're top of their game. They're sort of, you know, whether it's as an actor or a sports star or musician, they're off the top of their game. But the unifying factor is a willingness to make themselves vulnerable and do the uncomfortable. Mm. They don't need to come on Running Wild. They don't need to trust me with their lives. They don't need to trust the show with their brand. You know, they're top of their game. They don't need to risk that. But there's a willingness to always do the uncomfortable, embrace that uncertainty. And they love it. And it's what gives a glint in their eye. I mean, we were speaking earlier of Joe, you know, Ronnie, you know, Joe Woods. What's the exact relation? But sort of.
Joe Wood is my husband's. Well, she was his stepmom for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
So still classed as his stepmom.
Yeah. And so Ronnie Woods.
Our kids call her Granny Joe. She's Granny Joe in our house.
She's a legend. But
she's a legend.
We were talking about her because she did the island a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said to me before you said, I remember Joe coming back. She had a light in her eye, and a newfound. And you can't buy it.
No.
You know, drugs isn't going to give it to you. You know, status isn't going to give it to you. Power, money, no. You've got to earn it. And she earned it. She earned it a hard way on a month on an island through blood, sweat, tears.
Yeah.
But there's a power to that, and it's also how we're designed.
What happens in those moments, right? It's not just a case of, oh, I was really strong there, that felt good. It feels almost like when you go through uncertainty and you come out the other end, that you discover a new bit of yourself altogether. It's like an expansion, an opening of sorts. Like, oh my God, there's a whole new bit of me I didn't even realize. And again, that is liberating because sometimes we can get very stuck in, I'm like this, this is what I do, these are my limits. And actually, that's a load of nonsense.
It's a story.
It's a story.
It's a story we tell ourselves, and we tell the story long enough, it becomes us.
Yeah.
But life isn't exactly that bit you described, that bit that's a liberating and fun. You're creating new neural fibers and muscular fibers and spiritual stuff. And it's, you know, that's where life is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so let's think about people out there listening to this who are very fired up by this and thinking, this sounds great. I want that feeling. I want to feel maybe a bit more uncomfortable in situations and learn from that, whatever. There will obviously, of course, be people out there who have experienced trauma in, you know, varying degrees that feels like a real barrier to trying new stuff or doing something again. I've certainly got that. I've talked about it endlessly and without solution, but I find it very challenging to do live radio. I haven't done it for a very long time. It just feels like I can't go there anymore. That's perhaps a small example. There'll be people with much bigger stumbling blocks where they think, I can't get hurt again. Mm. I don't want to feel whatever feelings they've experienced. And you give the example again, a brilliant example of Maya Gibeira. Is that how you say her name, I think? Mm. And she's a Brazilian surfer who had a terrible accident on an 80-foot wave, spinal injuries, facial injuries. But then somehow, when she recovered, went back out and became the female record breaker, 70-odd-foot wave that she surfed impeccably. How do we metaphorically paddle back out? What gets us to that point of, you know what, I can try again?
Well, first of all, you will do it on live radio. You know, that's your story.
Feel sick about
it. It's a story. It's just a story. And that's you know, that's why I say when Everest is a state of mind, you know, we all have them. We all have them. You're right. We must never belittle the things, you know, because sometimes people face some giants in their life. And those giants, whatever, however we see them, they're very real and they're very powerful people and they can be very scary.
Yeah.
But all I know is that when the giants come, and we all have them, those green monsters on, you know, on our back that are kind of difficult, the really scary stuff. When we run, it gets worse. Same in the wild. You run from the wolves, you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, you're in the water with the sharks, you start panicking, you're food. You know, you got to swim strong, you know. And I think it's the same with life. The only way over our fears and the only way to that living energy we've just been talking about is always forward, is always towards the difficult stuff, you know. So whether that radio live thing for you or whatever it is, somebody, however big, you know, it doesn't matter what it is.
No.
And it doesn't matter how big it is. The way over them is to face it and start doing little things towards it. You know, it's like my mother-in-law is riddled with anxiety and a lack of confidence at the moment after COVID, you know. And, you know, to many people, it's like, oh, you know, it's like, come on, get over it, you know. But for her, it's a raw and real. And she just goes, come on, I can't do anything. And, you know, with her, it's like, Vinny, ring your daughter, ring Shara, tell her you love her. I can't do that. Text her. You know, small steps. And that's now moving forward.
Yeah.
And it's baby steps for something that's, you know, in the grand scheme, not that big a deal. But we all have things that to us are a big deal. But all I know is when we stop doing them, they get bigger and scarier.
Mm.
And her not texting Shara or ringing Shara or whatever, it just becomes bigger and worse. And then she won't do it for longer. And you've got to try and take just little incremental steps. And it's literally like a muscle, like our biceps. You know, how do you get your biceps bigger? You work it, you break it down, you feel the pain, you do the difficult, you struggle on that curl, and then you rest. You know, for you, for your life, I'm super excited for you when you, and you know, your story, like the surfer.
Yeah.
You know, the great stories of our time, the great movies, the great books, it will be your triumph, your Oscar, your Emmy, radio, whatever the equivalent
is,
you know?
Got to stop paddling back to radio too.
But if for no reason apart from, and it's nothing to do with the radio or,
no,
you know, eventually
not
winning the radio
all, yeah,
Oscar or whatever, that it's not about that. It's about you embracing the part that is primal and is good and thrives and struggles despite our fears.
Yeah.
And we all have the fears. That's why I find it difficult when people go, oh, you're fearless, or you're so. It's like, no, I'm not riddled with them.
You're just good at facing them.
But it's okay. Just I know the answer to my fears. Same with skydiving now. So I find after my accident, still horror for me. You know, that roar, the door, when that, you know, terrible. But I know the answer to the fears. You've got to face them. You've got to try and move towards them. And there's a power to embracing the difficult.
Yeah. Like, I remember reading back in the day, Suzanne Jeffers' Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, and just going, oh my God, I'm going to have to change so much because I really need to, like. And I did, whilst reading that book, this was probably 15 years ago, I remember reaching out to somebody that I'd found a real sort of barrier with, and it was terrifying, but it actually felt so much better than not reaching out and just sort of sitting there. And I guess we just
How
need to sort
is
of.
Is that the case? Though,
we need to get used to just feeling a bit terrified and a bit scared.
But even if it doesn't work,
it's
better than not doing it.
And this is not ridding ourselves of comfort. We have to have both, but it's not just sitting in, I just need to feel comfortable and safe.
But it's like the gym. Can't be at the gym 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You got to do your half an hour and then go and have the cup of tea and get comfortable.
Yeah.
But you've got to train the uncomfortable part.
So important. Talk to me about mentorship, because that's obviously a very important thing in your world. And it's something that I feel has been, I don't know, we've just sort of eradicated it in terms of on a normal societal level. Unless there is a structure in place, like luckily my son has a mentor at school, which has been massively helpful to his development and where he's at. But that, I think, is quite rare. And I've found myself later down the line finding accidentally a mentor who's a friend but has very openly said, I'm willing to mentor you in different ways. And we've got real sort of solid boundaries within that structure of what it means and what I can ask and what I can't, etc. And I feel very lucky to have someone that I can. She's not a therapist. She's just, she's a mentor for me in life. And I feel so grateful that I've got that. I know that that was probably an earlier realization for you because you lost your dad at a very young age and you instantly felt that loss of that guidance and having someone to be able to go to and share your thoughts and your worries. How did you find a mentor down the line, and how do you think we can really implement mentorship in modern life?
Gosh. I definitely felt bereft of that mentorship. I think that's probably what I found hardest. Losing my dad was just at a critical age when Shara and me were just getting together, 24, just getting married, starting out on our life. And then Shara's dad died in our first year of marriage. And then 10 weeks later, out of the blue, my dad died. And suddenly it was like year one of marriage, you know, early mid-20s. And it's like the anchors have gone on both of us. And I think, you know, and I was struggling, what am I going to do for work? I'd finished the military stuff. I was scratching around trying to figure out life. And I think that I really missed that time, you know. But then I kind of think, I had it so good for when I was a kid, you know, and it felt so soon to lose it. But I think the great story is always, it's always 5 minutes too early, isn't it? And you feel that breath. But actually, the really important stuff you've had it in those young years of love and support and encouragement. And I look back when I was like eight, always like whenever I had bad school reports, you know, my dad never minded. You know, he'd go straight to the effort bit down the bottom. He'd go, look, you smashed it on that. It's the only thing that mattered. The rest are details, you know. Be a good friend to people. You know, have a dream and don't listen to the dream seers that are going to tell you you're daft. Just you be unashamedly, I'm going to go for that. I'm going to fail often and my effort grade up here is going to stay up there. You know, the rest are details. And I'd like, oh, roll my eyes or whatever, you know. But so right, you know. And actually, he'd equip me with the important stuff. But I definitely, as the years went on, there's so many times I wanted to say, oh, what do we do here? Or what do we do here? And I think now it's a role, isn't it? As us as parents, you're a wonderful mum and we've got three boys. And, you know, it's the most important part of our journeys is trying to pass on the good stuff. You know, I've had a couple of people who've really helped me over the years. But I think so much of the real stuff I've learned just through failure. You know, I really do. I look back and I think, gosh, if I had never gone, that was a really bleak, dark time where I felt, where do I go here, left or right? And I didn't have the answer and I went the wrong way and then I went the wrong way again and then I picked the right way by luck and then, you know, endless sort of crossroads of failures and get back up and go again. And I do think if you fail enough, you get there. And sometimes this message gets lost on our kids. It gets lost on, I see it with young scouts, you know, young people are often very averse to the failure because it always makes us vulnerable. But it's the only way to progress. It's just that stepping stone, that doorway. We've got to go through it. And sometimes our boys go, oh, Papa, you hit gold on that or you smash it. It's like, yeah, but do you know what? Look behind the door of that one because, you know, I actually listed out our TV shows and the number of different series we've done that have been failures to them over the years. And it was something like for the five or six series over the years that have worked, there was something like 25 separate shows on separate networks that have failed. In fact, I went so far as to say to our boys, I said, in terms of the number of separate TV shows on separate networks, I've had more TV flops than any other person in history. I cannot think of another person across any genre.
I might be able to beat you on that.
Had so many. I mean, it's like 30 cancelled series on different, you know. And they were, oh, I didn't even know about that one. But that's the point.
Yeah.
And I'm not ashamed or embarrassed by any of those failures, because they're the stories, they're the scars, they're the marks, they're the stripes that I wear with pride.
Yeah.
That got you to the good stuff.
We're so worried about what other people will think about us if we fail openly. You know, if someone sees us fall flat on our face. I think there's a part of it where we think, oh, that hurt a bit. But the bigger piece is, what will everyone think of me? I think we're so flawed by that. And I think that's probably only getting worse because of social
media.
People
would be relieved.
Relieved.
You know?
Like, oh, you're failing too. Good.
So good. Thank goodness you're part of the human race.
Exactly.
I actually really noticed that. When I first started doing TV and I was like really proud of a show and I get my friend, go, check this out, can't you? I was like, no. And everyone's a bit like, oh. And then I learned over the years, when people sort of ask stuff as how stuff's going, I stopped kind of saying, oh, that won or that got an award or that. I started going, oh, a few battles at the moment. But anyway, how are you? And they go, oh, I'm glad you said that. Yeah, I'm having a nightmare. You know, and then they're away on their stuff.
Yeah, it's connective. Sorry. It's really connective.
So I think people love you all the more for the failures.
Yeah.
And it's part of life and nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, I love that quote of that 104-year-old who was interviewed in the newspaper the other day. And they said, so what's the best thing about being 104? She went, no peer pressure.
Brilliant.
You know, finally, she can actually, this is not, who's she performing for? She reads a book she likes, she'll, you know, have a cup of tea with 10 sugars, and if she wants, you know, she's no one to impress or worry what they're going to say.
I think we're so stumped by that constantly.
But how powerful to live like that. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we'd probably be all living very different lives if we did feel completely liberated from what other people thought about us or the commentary.
But people say that we all have two phases of our lives. One is when we do everything in anticipation of how people are going to react to this. You know, all every motivation for everything is, what are people going to think of this, or how do I look in this, or how you know. And then the second half is like, it's okay. Just let it. This is who you are.
Yeah.
And it's good and it's bad. And it's struggles and it's doubts and it's like, but it's okay. It's like, here we are.
Yeah.
And some people hit that phase in their 20s. Some people in their 80s. Some people maybe never get there. But invariably, when you meet people and it's honest, you warm to them and they're living in a happier space.
Yeah.
Because it's less exhausting.
Yeah.
So that, I guess, it's good to try and get there.
It is. And you know, when you've met someone like that, there's a sort of magnetism about them. You want to be around them because you think, I want to live as sort of authentically and honestly as that. And you get a real sense of it when you meet people. I've certainly interviewed people. Well, I'm getting that sense certainly from you as well. You know, you're led very much by what you believe is right for you. And there is so much less concern about the sort of general consensus, which is, certainly what I'm aiming for. A word that you said a moment ago is something that it's a word that I'm fascinated by. And that's probably because I think the world we find ourselves in is one where we want the quick fix. Mm. There's seemingly lots of answers. If you read this one book, if you take this one supplement, if you, whatever it is, you do this one practice, that everything's going to, you're going to be fixed. It's all going to be fine. And actually, seemingly the key to everything, and you could probably apply this to, I'm imagining, all parts of life, is discipline. And no one really wants to hear that. It's a bit boring. It's hard work. It means I've got to do it every day forever. But it probably is the key to a lot of our peace and probably happiness.
Well, I think it gives us a structure and a framework to build the good stuff. But I think also you don't have to do those, you know, that can feel a long road if you've got to do it forever, every day. You know, I think you've got to give yourself and each other space to, you know, it's okay. Sometimes you're not going to feel like that. That's okay. But it's about your direction, isn't it? It's about saying, having a discipline of like doing your best. You know, sometimes doing your best, you can't even get up. I know people who, you know, and you can't, I don't want to ever belittle that. You know, it's something you're going to have that. But doing your best and trying to put a structure you know is going to give you like scaffolding thing to get to the good stuff. You know, you're never going to get up there if you've got no framework ever to build upon. And all these, all great things in life take a bit of hard work. You know, they take trying to force. I mean, there's that great, my mum always used to say that lovely quote of, well, it's a hard quote in some ways, but it says, commitment's doing the thing you said you'd do long after the mood you said it in has left you. And all of us go, I'm going, tomorrow I'm going to do this. And it's where the pints in hand and we're going to run the mile or what, you know. And then, but when 6 a.m., you know, when you don't feel like it, it's where you see what people are made of. And I'm not saying we've always got to be brilliant, because if you're just a total ninja on discipline, it's quite annoying, you're quite boring, you're quite inhuman, and there's no fragility in it. And life is all about the fragility. But I'm saying trying to build in structure and discipline is a key to all the good stuff. And as you say, it's a boring skeleton upon which all the muscle and the good stuff gets built.
I mean, because in the book you talk about optimism as being a habit rather than it being just, you know, that is how you were born, that's your natural sort of stay, is because, again, I think most people listening to this will either have previously found themselves in a bit of a negative loop, or they might be in one now. I've certainly been in that mental state where just everything seems to be going wrong and you can't see the wood for the trees and everything just feels a bit bleak. And actually, you can get into a better, healthier habit of optimism. Isn't just going to be for certain people. Anyone can be optimistic, but it, again, probably requires a bit of work.
Yeah, and it's a habit. Like you say, both are habits.
Yeah.
You know, being negative or being positive, it's the habits that we actually have trained ourselves to be.
Yeah.
Whether it's the good or the bad, we're responsible for it. And habits, when you form good ones, can feel really clunky to start with because you're on day one.
Yeah.
Well, day 20, I still feel clunky. But that state of mind to actually choose this thing, and before you know it, becomes you. And I do think the thing of enthusiasm or positivity is, it's not something you're born with. And, you know, I always remember being told, being the most enthusiastic person you know, and you won't go far wrong. And it was that thing of like, I'm going to put it on like a T-shirt, like a pair of socks in the morning. I don't feel like it, but I know one thing for certain, the day's going to be better if I tack it like that. And people go, well, why are you enthusiastic? And it's like, well, there's such an easy answer to that. The alternative. The alternative is I'm going to be cynical, I'm going to be bad-tempered, I'm not going to, you know, what. And I think if you put the T-shirt on, that positive habit, whatever it is, put it on long enough. Some days you go bare-chested. You know what? Doesn't matter. Whatever. I'm just not doing it. But if you're trying to move forward and putting on the T-shirt and the good pair of socks and the enthusiasm and the positivity and the kindness or whatever it is, eventually they become you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to spoil the end of the book, but you do end with a lovely thought that diamonds are formed under pressure. That sort of leaves us thinking about reframing pressure, essentially, rather than thinking of it as an awful thing, a terrifying prospect. It actually can cause something quite beautiful to happen. How do we stop pressure from completely squashing us? How do we emerge a diamond?
Yeah, I think just not being scared of the squeeze times. You know, squeeze times are opportunities. Storms are a chance to show your character and create your character and stand up and show who you know, who you can be. It's not necessarily who you are now, but who you can be. You can create your own stories in those. You know, it's hard to create the brilliant stuff when everything's just easy. You know, you create character and the diamonds under the pressure. You know, it's you know, nature's always our best teacher. You know, you take the coal, put it under 10,000 square pounds per inch or whatever, and you know, eventually 1,000 years later, the diamonds come out. And I think so many of us avoid the pressure situations because they expose us. But that's okay. If you don't mind sharing a bit of the vulnerability that ironically everyone's going to love you for anyway.
Yeah.
If you're not scared to fall down a few times and the odd explosion of the coal blasts out as black dust and it doesn't work, but everyone's going to laugh and love you all the more for it. If you're not scared of that and you do it enough and you know, you're building life and energy and that's pressure. Look what squeezing does. It creates energy. Look at wind over a mountain. As it hits it, it compresses, gets faster. You know, and eventually, yeah, you get the diamonds. But one thing I know is you don't get the diamonds without the squeeze. You know, that's not the way it works. And you know, I can speak to any of my Running Wild guests. I speak to any of your podcast guests. Nobody gets the good stuff without the the struggle.
Yeah.
And the irony is it's the struggle where life is.
It's so interesting because probably in the last 20 years, we've been given a really extreme example of that, which we've celebrated. And I'm not casting a shade on these TV shows or whatever. I'm merely sort of observing what they've perhaps represented. And that is the overnight success of someone who wins a reality show or becomes extremely famous, which we then probably conflate with some sort of success. And we go, oh my God, their life is amazing. It looks so shiny. It looks brilliant. But often you hear then interviews from those people 2-3 years later, and they don't feel like that. That felt probably amazing for a second. There was an emptiness after. Mm. There was something missing. And that was perhaps the building blocks to get to that place.
It's too fast.
It's too fast.
It blows up and then it blows up.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the real stuff. Play the long game in everything, in life, in your goals and your relationships. You know, don't just be brilliant for a night.
Yeah.
You know, be kind 20 years on.
Yeah.
Don't just be great for a moment. Be there in the big, you know, everything in nature says the same thing, doesn't it? You know, the thing of success, that stuff isn't success. I mean, you and me know that more. That is not success. You know, success really can only ever be measured in terms of our relationships. You know, I mean, I meet enough. You know, if you meet a billionaire and his kids don't speak to him, can you really say, tell me, is that a success? You know, you've won the most Oscars in the world, but your wife hates you, your kids hate you. You know, is that really, you know, our relationships are always the benchmark. It doesn't have to be one's marriage, but it can be our friendships and our depth and rooted in other people as well, rather than about our own trophies.
Yeah, and that doesn't have to be... you know, you've got 1,000 friends and you're out partying every night. It's like you have really decent one-on-one relationships. It could be with 3 people.
Yeah, one.
One, yeah.
You're rich. You're successful. You've done it. Your heart is happy.
Mm. Yeah.
It's how we're made as humans, isn't it? All about connection. Everything's about connection.
Yeah. And I mean, that's obviously an incredibly important part when you are on an adventure or you're leading a team. If you don't have those dynamics in place, it will not work. You can't go out there alone to succeed and fight and get and win and get there first.
The world laughs at it. Yeah. It laughs at our aspirations to be the first to a summit, to plant a flag on this, to conquer that. You're never conquering anything, you know. The real reason I love my job and have done it for so many years is always rooted in the relationships. You know, those guys, those camera teams, I work with the same guys I started from day one. And as you know, in the world of TV, that's very rare to keep the same. We've seen each other have families, get together, have kids. You know, it's like there's a depth and a trust when you're each other's lives, when you're each other's hands every day. And the dyno, every time when we have these folk on Running Wild, they come away, they go, wow, do you know what? I worked on, you know, this Mission Impossible movie for 9 months, and yet there's stronger bonds and dynamic in what I've just experienced in 36 hours with you guys than anything we had in that. Because there's an intensity there. There's a trust. There's a love. There's a care. There's history. You know, broken warrior. I'm not saying everyone's perfect. Everyone's, you know, we're all broken messes a lot of the time. But we've got each other's back in the big moments. And there's a power to that. And that translates to families and to friendships. And it's a huge part of my motivation for my job. And it happens also with the guests. You create great bonds. You know, you'd be roped to someone 24 hours a day. You get close.
Yeah. Yeah, it's brilliant. That's why your shows are so loved, because I think there's the adventure side, but it's also seeing that, like seeing the connection with, you know, possibly even a stranger, someone you've never met before, but having that experience is, you know, we're sort of all living vicariously through that, I think, a lot of the time. It's brilliant. And this is such a helpful book. I think people really love that it's bite-sized, that you can do these 2 days and think about that theme and have that self-reflection. I think it's just a brilliant read, and I loved it. So thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for being here today.
Yeah, so it's no literary masterpiece, but it's simple, practical things, weapons in your arsenal to stay mentally strong. We'll do our best anyway. But you're an amazing advocate for all of this stuff. You live and breathe it. Wonderful mum, champion of what you do. Keep going.
Thanks, Bear. Thank you. There you go. As Bear says, loads of weapons in your arsenal to stay mentally strong. Thank you so much for that chat, Bear. I had such a bloody great time, actually. We laughed a lot. What a brilliant, brilliant man. And his great book, Mind Fuel, is out now. More good stuff next week, so make sure you're back here for that by clicking the follow button wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can follow us on Instagram too. I hope you're already over there with us, but if you're not, we are at Happy Place Official. And we always love, love, love hearing what you're up to and how you're doing. So jump over and say hi. Okay, a massive thanks again to Bear, to the producer, Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you, you gorgeous lot. I love you.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.